Children who are born into poverty grow into adults seeking to create better lives for their own families. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, October 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a PBS Frontline film more than a decade in the making. Born Poor follows three kids as they dream, overcome, stumble, and survive a childhood without advantages. We'll talk with the filmmaker. Then, understanding adolescent brain development in the classroom and at home, Teacher Talk explores brain science to help students learn. That's coming a bit later in the hour. But first, the brutal attacks that shifted history 2 years later. What will it take to forge a durable peace in Gaza and Israel? That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today marks the two-year anniversary of the Hamas-led attacks on Israel. Around 1,200 innocent people were murdered, and militants abducted more than 250 civilians. The Israeli offensive that followed those attacks has killed around 67,000 Palestinians. Most of the dead are non-combatants. On Monday, representatives of Hamas, Israel, and the U.S. met in Egypt to hopefully begin finding a path to a durable peace. Tim Shorn is with the University of South Dakota. He's the director of international studies and an associate professor of political science.
Well, I think we start with the day of attack. And certainly Hamas should not have attacked the civilian population, taken the hostages. And I think we can all agree on that. Mm-hmm. It was a horrific event to attack a music festival and essentially execute those who were taking part in it. They were non-combatants. You know, to discuss the legal aspects, this was clearly a war crime. We move from there then, and we see obviously that the surprise attack that had Hamas on the offensive and surprising Israel switched to Israel gaining the upper hand very quickly and then proceeding to engage not just Hamas but the entire population of Gaza. And that has led us to where we are today. A very large death toll on the part of Palestinian civilians. Certainly a high number of Hamas fighters who have been killed, incredible destruction of the Gaza Strip with its infrastructure, educational institutions, housing being destroyed, and at the same time creating a pressure domestically on the Benjamin Netanyahu government as he attempts to navigate both his own self-identified domestic political needs, what he has created, kind of a maelstrom within the international community, and then determining when he has achieved the kind of military strategic goals that he has set out. So it is an incident that will live in infamy, and it has created a response on the part of the Israelis that will also live in infamy.
Yeah. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, which is the closest thing to an accurate prediction that we have or an assessment we have, more than 67,000 Palestinians have been killed. More than half of them have been women and children. Hundreds, I think more than 400, certainly more than 300 journalists have been killed, many of them intentionally. It is devastating.
It is. The amount of damage and killing is almost mind-numbing. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, the Gaza Ministry of Health is very careful about the numbers that they put out. And both the Biden government, when it was in charge, the Netanyahu government, they both criticized the Ministry of Health for inflating the figures. Mm-hmm. When one looks back at past conflicts, we find that, if anything, the Gaza Ministry of Health understates the number of casualties. Because generally speaking, they are not going to release a number until they have a body and a name to attach to that number. The Lancet, which is essentially the British version of the Journal of the American Medical Association, has argued that if anything, the Gaza Ministry of Health is underestimating the number of casualties by probably 30%. And so it's been a very costly conflict, especially for civilians, for non-combatants. It's also interesting how we reach that number, because oftentimes what we separate out from that number is males between the age of, let's say, 15 to 65, who it's difficult to determine whether or not they are a combatant. Obviously, not all males between 16 and 65 or 15 and 65 are combatants. But it sets aside the argument about the number of civilian or non-combatant casualties, where we see that it is probably close to two-thirds of the dead who are civilians and non-combatants. And so it's an interesting game that we see playing out when it comes to identifying casualty numbers. But it is fairly clear, looking back and then looking at how numbers are ascertained today, that the Gaza Ministry of Health is fairly conservative in their release of casualties.
All right. So what happens around a negotiation table? Right now we see President Trump bringing forward a 20-point peace plan, as I understand it. Are all the main actors at the table, or are there people missing? Where do you want to begin with the opportunity for peace here?
Well, all of the actors were not at the table. Oftentimes, agreements that are created to end a conflict between Israelis and Palestinians leave the Palestinians out. Not always. There have been some obvious exceptions. Oslo, which was obviously Norwegian-led, Camp David. But more often than not, it is one or two parties at the table. This was a plan that the Trump administration prepared, presented it to Israel, and then moved forward. So it is an imposed plan on Gaza and the Palestinians. That being said, it takes me back to the UN partition plan of Palestine in 1948, where the Israelis accepted it because they knew that the Palestinians and the Arabs would reject it. It's very possible that the same thing is occurring now, because there are clearly folks in the Netanyahu cabinet in the Israeli government who are opposed to this agreement and are just waiting for ways to pull the plug on it. So this is very much an imposed program on the part of the Trump administration, who is doing, you know, a great deal of the lifting and then just waiting, I would argue, for the Israelis to kind of pull the rug out from under it at some point.
What is the pressure on Hamas at this moment?
Well, the pressure on Hamas is either release the hostages and essentially surrender, or will once again unleash the hounds, that we will give a green light to the Israelis to continue their sweep into the Gaza Strip, and essentially anything that could remotely be identified as Hamas to be obliterated. And we see that, you know, that's a bit of a liberal targeting strategy. And we also know that from looking back through statements of members of the Israeli Defense Forces, of non-governmental organizations, and others, that the rules of engagement have at best been liberal and at worst been absent as the Israeli forces sweep through Gaza. And so that explains the incredible amount of damage done to housing, to the infrastructure, leveling of entire towns and cities in Gaza. And this is not in opposition to what President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu believe, this is not going to be a way to push the Palestinians to accept a peace proposal. If anything, we are preparing the next generation of Palestinians who will oppose Israel at every turn.
To this point, Hamas has said, or I read in news coverage, that there are 48 hostages remaining. Only about 20 of those people are actually alive. And that Hamas has said, we can't return everybody that quickly because some of their bodies are buried under rubble. Does that sound genuine to you? Does that sound like a stalling tactic, a negotiation tactic? What are we to make of that?
I mean, it could be a bit of both. It does ring true to me. I mean, it goes back to the original attack where, we shouldn't even be talking about hostages. This should not have occurred. But given how long the hostages have been held, given the amount of destruction that has occurred, it's very likely that there are very few hostages alive and that they can access all of the bodies of the hostages. Mm-hmm. So that part rings true. At the same time, my guess is that Hamas has some doubt about what happens the day after all of the hostages who are accessible have been returned or the bodies repatriated. I would guess that they're expecting it's at best 50-50 as to whether or not the Netanyahu government abides by the agreement.
Yeah. So Hamas' central demand is that Israel will not resume large-scale operations once those hostages are returned. How likely is that?
I would argue that given the current structure of the Netanyahu government, at some point the Israeli attack, the offensive, will resume. I certainly can't say that with complete certainty, but the Netanyahu government is now a minority government that depends on other conservative parties to support it in important votes. So to lose another conservative, and in some cases very far-right coalition partner, would bring down the government and would result in new elections. And Netanyahu certainly does not want to see that happen. So if it is either potentially upsetting the Trump administration or losing power, Prime Minister Netanyahu will certainly go with upsetting the Trump administration. And I would argue he would be able to spin it in a way that the Trump administration would accept.
Hmm. We've been talking about Hamas, but then Hamas does not represent all Palestinians by any stretch. Is there a Palestinian authority of some kind? Is there another leadership structure that needs to come to this table? Help me understand that at this point.
There is. We have the Palestine Authority that is based in Ramallah, which is in the West Bank. And there has been a political division between the Gaza Strip and West Bank since the last Palestinian election when Hamas won. But we and the Israelis refused to accept the election results and encouraged the PLO and the old Palestine Authority to essentially overthrow the Hamas-led government, which they did, which then resulted in the divide with Hamas on the Gaza Strip and the more secular Palestine Authority and Western-accepted Palestine Authority in Ramallah. The problem with the Palestine Authority in Ramallah is that it is not a particularly popular government either. Mm-hmm. It is a government that has been corrupt, which is one of the reasons why Hamas won in the last elections anyway. It is made up of people who have lost kind of contact, if you will, with the regular people. It has not really achieved anything. It seems intent on staying in power for the sake of staying in power. And so to a great extent, Most Palestinians consider them irrelevant. And, you know, at another level, with the continued Israeli occupation of the West Bank, the expansion of settlements, the divisions that they have made within the West Bank, the Israelis have made the Palestine Authority pretty irrelevant as well. And we have certainly aided and abetted that. So the idea that somehow a different or technocratic Palestinian government will come into being in Gaza is probably unlikely. One, it would have to have at least some support by the Gazan people. Now, that being said, Hamas has lost a significant amount of support in the Gaza Strip, but we have also ensured that there is no one to take their place. And so this is going to be a long-term problem. Mm. We have done everything we can to undermine Palestinian leadership, and it's going to be hard to find somebody to fill the bill that we have created to lead Gaza, you know, in the next days, weeks, months, years.
Yeah. Hmm. You mentioned, again, at the beginning of our conversation, October 7th, as a, you know, war crime. And since that time, the United Nations has also issued a report saying the extent of Israel's retaliation qualifies under a very strict legal framework as genocide. The dust isn't going to settle anytime soon, but what I'm wondering is the consequences of some of those actions and any kind of accountability in the future to the perpetrators of those actions. Is that just a ridiculous thing to think that there might be consequences for some of those actions?
It's hard to say. Certainly, the Human Rights Council came out a couple of weeks ago declaring what Israel is doing is genocide. But prior to that, we had B'Tselem, which is the leading Israeli human rights organization, and Israeli Physicians for Human Rights, both declaring what the Israeli government is doing as genocide, as meeting the legal definition under both the Genocide Convention and the Statute of Rome, which created the International Criminal Court. The ironic thing is that most of those amongst Hamas who would have been tried under these treaties have been killed. So they're kind of figuratively off the table. As far as the Israeli government members who could be tried, which includes Prime Minister Netanyahu and both the past and current defense ministers, are being protected to a great extent by the United States. The Trump administration has placed sanctions on those who are part of the International Criminal Court process, including looking at placing sanctions on justices and the lead prosecutor. And so that makes it very hard for certainly the international community as a whole to find anybody or hold anyone accountable. That being said, because of the nature of the crime of genocide, any country in the world could put, if they acquired him, Prime Minister Netanyahu on trial for genocide because of the universal nature of the crime. Mm. That does mean then that Prime Minister Netanyahu and some of his cabinet members are going to have to be somewhat cautious about which countries they land in the future. Because there are some countries who would be very willing to put him on trial for war crimes, for crimes against humanity, and ultimately genocide. Mm. But the United States has been rather singular in its opposition to any legal movement, any legal prosecution of Israeli leaders, and will do everything it can to delegitimate the international institutions and protect Prime Minister Netanyahu and others who could be accused of crimes.
Yeah. So what does a durable peace look like in this scenario?
And here is the perhaps the cynic in me, but I guess durable will probably be measured in maybe weeks and months, but it certainly will not be measured in years because we have ensured that there is going to be another generation of Palestinians who oppose Israel And obviously, all of the Palestinians are opposing the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which combined constitute the state of Palestine. So a durable peace is not going to be an infinite peace. It will be very finite if it comes into being. Otherwise, we are looking at the continued destruction of Gaza and potential annexation of parts, if not all, of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which will ensure future conflict.
Yeah, and some Israelis who will never feel safe again.
Right. There are, you know, the nature of the Hamas attack, it's a lot like the attack that occurred on Yom Kippur in 1973. Mm-hmm. And that was that Israel felt itself to be invincible, and there were people who failed to do their jobs in Israeli government and the Israeli military and failed to see the attacks coming. That is not to excuse the attacks, but that is to say that at times there is a certain arrogance or invincibility that permeates the Israeli government. And it's possible, it's not possible, it's real, that aura of invincibility has been incredibly shaken on the part of Israeli civilians as they look to recover from the trauma of that attack. And that's a trauma, especially in certain regions of Israel, that is going to live on for a generation or more. And so that's, you know, we're looking at, you know, people on both sides of the border, if you will, who will be living with a long-term trauma and a sense of insecurity, being forgotten for a generation or more to come.
That's USD's Tim Shorn. He's Director of International Studies and an Associate Professor of Political Science. Up next, we explore frontline reporting that has followed children into adulthood, children who were born poor. That's coming up after a break. You're in the Moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. More than 10 years ago, the documentary Poor Kids followed three children as they navigated poverty. These kids' stories didn't end when the film premiered, of course, and the cameras never stopped rolling. Born Poor from PBS Frontline is a follow-up to Poor Kids. It follows Kaylee, Johnny, and Brittany as children, teenagers, and then as young adults. The documentary premieres tonight on SDPB-TV. Check your local listings. You can also find it online and on the PBS app. With a preview, here is filmmaker Jezza Newman.
I think what really strikes home is how intelligent they are, and I think that it really, this film really highlights, you know, how there are plenty of Einsteins out there who will never become an Einstein because they won't, you know, they won't be afforded those, or nuclear, you know, amazing doctors, amazing surgeons, amazing people that could change the world will never be realized because they just won't have the mobility, they won't have that social mobility because these kids are so articulate about their world.
Yeah.
You know, people like to say people who are poor are stupid. They're not at all. You know, it incredibly intelligent children who just aren't afforded the opportunities that others might be. And that really strikes, and you see that later on. I mean, in the new film with them as adults, when they can look at themselves and how aware they can be of, I mean, Brittany comes out with some absolutely stunning statements that I think most organizations working in this field would want to quote her forever, because her understanding of the cycle and Kaylee's understanding of the and drawing on PTSD and understanding the traumas that you grow up with as a child. And I think what you really see is how, as a child, there's an innocence to it, right? You don't see the effects so acutely to those child. You just see an awareness. You see the effects when, obviously, Kaylee has to give up a dog, and it's sad. But other than that, they're still out on their bikes. They're still, you know, being kids. But as they grow older, you then start to realize that deep down they're actually absorbing it. They're sponges. You know, children are sponges, and they are sponges of that poverty cycle.
And to that point, Kaylee, and I wanted to ask you this about filming it, because Kaylee says she doesn't, as an adult, that moment where she's giving up her dog or has to surrender her dog because they can't take care of it, she doesn't remember that. And she remembers it largely through your filmmaking. You've kind of given that to her as a gift, but she is processing the fact that, why wouldn't I remember that? And, oh, that is connected to the trauma of it. Tell me a little bit about the gift of giving these young adults this piece of their childhood as evidence of what they were going through as kids. How does that intersect with their healing and their frustrations as adults, as they see themselves repeating some of their parents' patterns, for example?
I think that what it does, what it has done, is kind of on two levels. So one is, yes, it's been a record of some traumas, you could argue, you know, you could even argue that if we show it to them, we're re-traumatizing them. But in fact, you know, what they take from it is an understanding of what they went through, and it's actually given them an inner strength to try as best they may to not repeat the cycle, not to do the same thing. But obviously, what they're learning too, and what they have to, you know, come to terms with, is it's almost like fighting a tsunami. You know, it's what they're in, the world they're in, the cycle they're in, all the forces are against them because they don't have that social mobility. And without somebody there to give you that armband, to give you that flotation device, you will go away with the waves. You know, that's the way it's going to happen. I mean, Brittany articulates it phenomenally when she talks about falling in the hole and grasping at tree roots and grasping at, and that's what it's like. And so many people in poverty will tell you every day is like a natural disaster. You know, you're fighting to try and survive and find how do you do better. And I think what the film has done is kept a record of what they went through, so in a way it does give them an understanding of what they went through, and they kind of can dip back and see, well, yeah, I really did. It's not something I've made up in my head. It's not that it didn't happen. It really happened. Even though I can't remember giving up my dog, I did. And as an adult, I can understand that must have been really traumatic for me. So if I'm showing certain behaviors, it's not in the film, but Kaylee said to me at one time, you know, at times she felt so depressed she didn't want to get out of bed. You know, she just wanted some days, she just wanted to stay in bed. But she realized that that was not the way forward. She needed to do something. So her challenge was to just to do one thing. And if she could read in bed, then at least she had achieved an act of reading. And then that helped her with her mental health. And she realized, okay, well, I've read a book. I haven't just stayed in bed. So that gave her the motivation. Well, if I can read a book, maybe I could get up and I could wash one dish. And if I've washed one dish, maybe I could do two or three. So she found mechanisms to help her overcome those moments of depression. And I think the one thing that the film has given them and still gives them is a project in their lives, in a way. And they understand there are rules to it, right? I can't step in and help and change their life. I, as well as having a duty of care towards them as a children, I also have a duty to be honest and true to viewers, right? So I can't say that she's given up her dog to the pound, but meanwhile, I've gone and taken the dog out of the pound and given it back to her, right? You can't do things like that. It has to play out, as painful as it might be. I'm there to observe the truth. But we have built a relationship with all three of the children that we're able to maintain that position. But for them, that's okay, because we're adults in their lives who have stood by, even if it might be to, you know, to gain from them in a way, you could argue, because we're making a film. But actually, this film is collaborative. You know, they know I can't make this film without them. So if they said one day, I don't want to film, which Kaylee did once when we were filming with her, she said, I'm too hungry, I can't film. So you have to respect that. And for Kaylee, the driver, very much, and also Brittany, to be fair, and Johnny, is that very much they want people to understand. They kind of feel that they're so in it now, and that we've done it this time as well, that they want the world to try, they want to be part of trying to get across an understanding of what it's like to grow up in poverty, to spill the rumors and the misconceptions around poverty. You know, Brittany was bullied as a child at times, and she was told she was poor, which meant she was dirty, which meant sometimes she had to wear her brother's clothing, and you get teased for that. And there will be thousands of children who are listening to this who live through this every day. You know, you are put down and put down and put down, and there'll be parents as well who are put down and misunderstood because they're poor, because they might not be able to have a shower, because they're having to save water because they can't afford it. So they, you know, there are parents that go without baths because, or a shower because they hold the bath water for their children, and their children will use it first, and then they'll only use it once the children abuse it. There are people doing that every day in America. And I think that the children want to be part of trying to get people to understand, actually, the children going through this and the adults going through these situations, more often than not, are very intelligent, clever people who want to be a beneficial part of society. They want to help society. They want to be doing a job. They want to be being constructive. They don't want to be reliant on others, you know.
Yeah. I'm wondering what you saw, because, you know, I think of Johnny as a young child really saying, you know, you can be whatever you want to be. I have a dream to play football. I know I'm going to have to work super hard, but I can do it. And then as he gets older and it gets the path gets more narrow and it seems harder and harder to find his way to any kind of college football program, he keeps saying, you know, if I keep working hard, is all this hard work for nothing? Tell me from your perspective as a filmmaker and as taking this journey with them, the ways that you saw their relationship with hope and optimism change, and the ways that you saw their relationship with I can make my life better solidified.
Unfortunately, you do see very small, you know, it's quite small steps where you see the optimism slightly waning or the reality dawning. You know, I think Kaylee, you know, articulates that quite nicely towards the end of the film, when she talks about, you know, she talks about, I had these certain plans, they just didn't work out in the order I hoped they would. But sometimes in life, you've got to realize life doesn't play out like that, and that's okay. So already she was trying to justify why her, and I don't want to do too many spoilers on the film.
Right,
it's like, but you know, her life didn't pan out quite how she thought it would. But she's coming to justify it. I think with Johnny too, of course, he's coming to that point where the options are narrowing. He still believes there's opportunity, but I think, but it is that you see subtly, he starts to realize that, you know, they are waning, and that maybe money would have had a bigger effect on him and his opportunities than he first allowed himself to believe. I think he believed that hard work and effort would get him where he needed to go. But I think now he's starting to realize that actually those with money have better opportunities. They can go to better gyms, so they can buy better equipment. You know your parents will know people who know people. That's what social mobility is all about, right? It's like, unfortunately, if you come from, you know, professional upbringings, then you're going to know the person that knows the person. You'll get into better colleges, you'll get tutors, you'll, and colleges where you're seen as a football player. So for Johnny, who's trying to play football, it's really tough to get noticed from, you know, a non-first string university. So, and at first he believed that, you know, he has a faith too. So he believed in his faith, and he thought there'd be a path that would take him where he needed to go. But I think obviously as he became a father and then has responsibilities there, and he's really dedicated as a father, so he doesn't want his family to go hungry, he's beginning to realize, of course, the balance has to shift, and his dreams may have to start to take more of a back seat while he puts food on the table. I think that, like all of us in life, we have to adapt and change. I don't think you have to give up completely on your dreams. I don't think it's unrealistic to keep having them. I think, as Kaylee pointed out too, the dreams are what kept her going. You know, the dream, she even says, you know, that the dream of a better life than the one you're living is the thing that gets you through the day to day. So, and I think that's true for everybody. You know, when you're feeling down, and let's say, you know, feeling down about life isn't only for those living in poverty. Everybody right. feels down at life. And I think that there are life lessons you can take from these children beyond the world of the cycle of poverty, quite frankly. You know, yeah. their attitude and outlook and their understanding of how do you lift yourself up from and how do you keep going. And it's about setting targets. And I think that with Johnny, he kept setting that target. And sure, he'll probably have to change the target. For now, his target is to put food on the table. So he's put his dream on the back burner. But that doesn't mean it's over, and it might adapt and change. And maybe when he realizes, you know, at some point he'll decide he's not going to play football, but maybe he could be a coach. You know, maybe there'll be a university.
How did making this film change you over the years?
Obviously, you know, I'm very self-aware of my own life and what I have. And one of the things that had a fundamental change was I interviewed Brittany on one of the trips. I interviewed Brittany in the first film, and I left Brittany and went home to my own family. And my daughter is the same age as Brittany. Mm. So I went home and I realized that what I do as a filmmaker is I am an adult in their life who asks them questions and listens for hours and hours and hours. And I never tell them they're wrong. I never, you know, interrupt them. I never have to do any of those things because I'm not a parent. I'm not a teacher. It's a very unusual adult to have in your life as a child, right? Mm-hmm. Someone who is trusted by the family, but just ask questions and listens, right? So I went home and I interviewed my daughter because I realized as a parent, I don't actually listen to my daughter. I hear her and we hear our children, but we don't listen because we're a parenting. So they try to tell you something about something they did and you go, oh yeah, but you shouldn't do it that way. You should really do it this way. Or, okay, yes, that's a lovely story, but you need to eat your dinner because you've got to do your homework. You would never sit down with your child and just listen to them for 2 hours and let them just go with whatever they want to go with. And my daughter started talking about polar ice caps and recycling and a whole world that I never envisaged was in her head. And I still have that interview today. And that really fundamentally changed the way I tried to parent. And I desperately tried to give my children time. And even when I'm absolutely flat out, and even to this day, I'll check myself when I'm like, okay, look, I can't take a call right now. I've got, you know, I need to grade the film or do this or do that. I'm like, no, take a breath. Just give them their time and then move on. It's okay. And I think that's one of the fundamental changes these kids have had on me and how they've, that was, it was Brittany and that, and coming back from that trip really made me change how I deal with my children.
That's Jezza Newman. He's filmmaker behind the new PBS Frontline documentary, Born Poor. It premieres on SDPB TV tonight. More in the Moment is coming up after the break. We will talk about the brain science of adolescence with our teacher talk. You're in the Moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Teenage years can be confusing for students, parents, and teachers alike, between bursts of independence, emotional ups and downs, and risk-taking behavior. It can feel like teenagers are wired differently. Well, that's because they are. Our Teacher Talk educators help us explore what's really happening inside the adolescent brain and how understanding that can make a difference in the classroom and at home. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She is an adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. She has been teaching for more than 25 years. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. We are going to honor the teenage brain Jackie, this expands on the conversation we had with Gina about brain science, and that still has you thinking. Tell us a little bit about where you picked up where Gina Benz had left off with brain science for the next Teacher Talk column.
Yes. I had a lot of thoughts after our last conversation, and as I mentioned in the Brain Science Matters chat that we had, this is also part of my area of interest as an academic. This is what I did some of my dissertation research on. I'm just very curious about how young people learn, how we develop. But also, I'm particularly interested in teenagers. I find them to be really endearing and really challenging and very complicated. And I don't think I'm alone in that way. So it also kind of was serendipitous that after we had that conversation, I happened to read a couple of articles about the teenage mind and about the brain science of adolescence. And so I thought, let's continue the conversation.
Tell us some of the things that you found right away.
Sure. The first article I ran into was Edutopia. For those educators out there that haven't found Edutopia, or maybe all of you are laughing like, no, we found this so much longer ago than you are talking about. but it is George Lucas's blog. So there's a lot of creative, there's just really great resources on this blog. And then also it has kind of a creative lens to it in my
sure.
mind.
Yeah.
But the article I found was called Project's Purpose in the Teenage Mind. And it is about a researcher who is talking about how teenagers are really wired for purpose. They like big questions. They like questions about identity, about justice, about meaning. They're in this state of transcendence because that is where developmentally they are. From 14 to about 24 or 25, their prefrontal cortex is still developing. And so they are asking really existential questions. That's where their minds are at. And so I've found that that's why I liked being a high school teacher. It's why I really like working at the university level, because we're in these, in my mind, like really meaningful conversations with people who are in that age.
Yeah. Gina, is that what you like about teaching high schoolers as well, that you like that age, obviously?
It's one of many things I like. I also like just walking with them through their activities and their experiences with prom and getting a job and starting to drive. But to answer your question, yes, yes, and yes. Teenagers love those existential, deep questions. They want to figure out the world. They want to figure out themselves. And I know this because when people say, here's what I really like about your class, because I often ask students, what am I doing well? What do you think I could do better so I can be the best teacher possible for you? And they always say, keep the discussions, keep the discussions. Mm. They like to have discussions. And a lot of times the discussions can start at a surface level, but they like to figure out how to make it go deep. And some talk and some just like to listen. And I always provide some time, too, for them all to write so that they can all get their ideas out somewhere.
Yeah. So I love what you say in this companion blog, Jackie, because it's not that adolescence is a parking ramp until
you get to... Oh, yeah, a waiting room for adulthood.
It's not a waiting room for adulthood. There are developmental things that are happening right during this time. What are some of those things, and how can adults support the teenagers in their lives?
Yes. It is a critical stage of growth. It is a period of learning in its own right. They are developing. We talk a lot about boundaries on this show. That is what teenagers are learning so much about themselves. Boundaries really is a question of what is or is not okay for me. Mm-hmm. And then also what happens when I test the boundaries of the people around me, right? And so that, I think, is often misunderstood as defiance or as teenagers are misunderstood so frequently, right? But they are really are going through this developmental period of learning about who they are, how they fit into society, what is and is not okay for them. And so giving them opportunities to play around in that area is what they need. They need opportunities to try by doing and make mistakes so that they learn what the boundaries are of something. They don't want to be told. It's developmentally, when we talked about Soretta Hammond's work, she's saying the role of the teacher is to move from dependence to independence. Teenagers are telling us that every day. If you tell them something, they are going to defy it. So they're trying to find their own independent way through. So the more opportunities that we can give them to get their hands dirty, try it for themselves, make mistakes, find their own path, that is them learning their own way to independence rather than being, I don't know, coached or told what to do.
Yeah. So Gina, what does that sound like in a dialogue? Because we'll talk about like teacher pathway and some of the, you know, hands-on experiences that adolescents need to have and value. But you just were talking about keeping a discussion. And I hear Jackie saying they have to learn how to make mistakes. That means when you're in a discussion with your peers, you're going to screw up.
Yeah. So in the classroom, you teach them how to have discussions while they're having discussions.
Okay.
You teach them how to have civil discourse, how to listen to each other, how to respond in thoughtful ways,
okay,
respectful ways, and also how it's okay to change your mind.
Mm.
It's okay to change your mind when you get new information. When you know better, you do better, right? So that's part of it. I also want to say with that dependence to independence thing, I see that at the high school level when it comes to parent-teacher conferences. Some people get all worried because not a lot of parents are coming to parent-teacher conferences, and I think that might be developmentally appropriate for many families, not all,
mm-hmm.
for many families. For my own kids, I wanted them to take more control of their learning and their school experience
sure.
as their mom because they needed more independence, and part of that was not going to parent-teacher conferences anymore and saying, this is your grade. And you have to be willing to let them suffer consequences. Like Jackie said, you said it quickly, but it is so important. You have to let kids make mistakes, especially while they're young and still in your care. Make the mistakes then rather than make the mistakes when you're 23, 24, 25,
yeah.
30.
Yeah.
Well, and developmentally, their brain is wired for that type of learning. They're actually quite resilient from mistakes, which I think is something that's also misunderstood because this is just anecdotal experience. It seems like when a mistake happens sometimes to a teenager, it can feel really wrought with strife and tears. You know, there can be a lot of emotions around it. But what they're doing there, too, is building resilience around the mistakes and learning from them very rapidly. Like I was saying at the beginning, their prefrontal cortex is not developed yet. And so to have these opportunities to experience the failures, the struggles, the things that didn't go well is also building neural pathways and growing resilience and strength in this part of their brain that is supposed to be developing during that time period.
Hmm. All right. So what are some of the ways that students can learn by doing? That the teenage brain learns by doing? Gina talked about having a conversation, but what are some of the other ways, Jackie? And by the way, adolescence goes to
Till 24.
Till 24.
Through college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so through college. Yeah.
That surprises me.
That brain development is happening mm-hmm. through college. So what mm-hmm. are some of the other ways that we're learning by doing?
Well, there's another book, and I haven't read the book, but I watched the interview from Lisa Lawson is the author, and the book is called Thrive, How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. Mm-hmm. And she was interviewed on PBS. And so I ordered the book after watching the interview. But she just had some really great ideas that I wanted to share. The main one that I took away in it, I think it was because we're doing a lot of this at the University of South Dakota in the School of Education, and so I was feeling proud of this work. But is it what's called experiential learning, which is learning by doing. Mm-hmm. So in college, it's very common to get an internship, an externship, do a practicum, have a field experience, and that work is critical to development because it's showing them through doing if you like the work that you might be doing in the future. Does this suit you? Does this fit you? And so every opportunity for that learning by doing, the hands-on experiences for adolescents is really important.
That's Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. There is more to this Teacher Talk conversation. Listen to the full segment online at SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngerman and Alan Kester. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for listening.